How is everyone this morning? If you're a visitor here, I'd just like to extend my own welcome to you. It's great to have you here. We're on to week three of three of a short series that we're doing, which is called Love As Jesus Loved. And last week, Steve talked about the washing of feet, and he talked about servanthood, and he made three key points. Now, can anyone, apart from Steve, remember those points? HP sauce, fantastic. HP sauce, brown sauce, we all love it. What did the H stand for? Humility, humble, be humble. And the P?
Practical.
And the S, someone over here? Be humble, be practical, be spiritual. And that was about servanthood that Steve talked about. And I'm really glad that people have remembered that. Because that means you didn't completely waste your time. So today we're going to be talking about breaking of bread, which sounds a bit like an Easter message. So coming in December, that seems not quite right, but I'm going to try and give it a slightly different slant. And I'm also going to try and give it a slightly different slant from where Steve took it last week. So I'm going to spend a bit of time digging around in the Old Testament and looking at the history behind it and the background. And then we're going to make some points about breaking of bread. Right, so we're going to start in the book of Exodus. So the Israelites are in Egypt and they're enslaved in Egypt. They'd arrived in Egypt 400 years earlier as a family, and they turned from a family to a nation, and they'd also turned from a family that had been invited to come to a nation in slavery in Egypt. And God decided that the time was ripe for this nation to move out of slavery and to move into the promise that God had given to their forebears. And so he chose a man, and the man was called Moses. And Moses discussed with Pharaoh about the release of the Israelites from slavery. And God sent 10 plagues onto the Israelites. And you can read about these plagues in chapters 7 to 10. And the first plague was I think the river turned to blood, and the next plague was the plague of frogs, and the next plague was the plague of gnats, and it went on. There was a plague on cattle, there was a plague on there was a plague of flies, I think, and boils. And this all went on, and each time Pharaoh hardened his heart and refused to release the people. And then we come on to the final plague in chapter 11. And right from where we read it, we can tell that there's something different going on here. So I'm going to read quite a lot from chapters 11 to 12, but I'm also going to jump about a bit, so you may find it's a bit difficult to follow. And I'll put my glasses on, Ray Lowe style. So here we go. Now the Lord had said to Moses, I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here, and when he does, he will drive you out completely. So Moses said, this is what the Lord says, about midnight I will go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the female slave who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there has ever been or ever will be again. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. So already, instead of just being a plague that's just going to happen, the Lord has told them, you're going to do something special. You're going to do something different. You're going to gather together. You're going to protect your households, and therefore the plague will not touch your houses. And it's going to be a lasting ordinance. You are going to do this every year to remember this. So this plague stands out from the others. Moving on to verse 21. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood in the basin and put some of the blood on the top and on the sides of the door frame. None of you shall go out of the door of your house until morning. When the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians, he will see the blood on the doorframe and pass over that doorway. Obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants. When you enter the land that the Lord has given you, as he has promised, observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord, who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. The Israelites did just what the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt. So a couple of things I'm going to pull out from here. First of all, I still remember back in the 19, whenever it was, when I was a child, and we did this at school, and the teacher was telling us that they ate special unleavened bread, and the inevitable hand went up, please, sir, what's unleavened bread? Oh, that's bread made without yeast. Well, what's that? Well, that's bread that's not made with yeast. Well, what does that mean? We'd never eaten anything. We didn't know even what that meant. Now, these days, because we're so cosmopolitan, we know about bread made without yeast. We have flatbreads from all over the world, and some of these are breads made without yeast. But at that time, we didn't know what it was. So they ate a different sort of bread. We don't use that sort of bread now when we share, when we break bread together. But they had a kind of a special bread. And they also had had lamb with bitter herbs. Now, I've had lamb with bitter. But again, this was probably a bit different. It was a little bit unusual. Now, interestingly, it says there's a piece about household has to eat the whole lamb. And if there's not enough in your household, gather together with households around you so there's enough. Now, my mental picture is that a whole lamb is quite a lot of meat. So I imagine that they gathered in fairly decent extended family groups. They called their neighbours in together and said, come on, let's do this together. There were big groups doing this. It wasn't a little nuclear family, mum, dad and 2.4 children. They were big groups getting together. So this was a real sizable celebration. Now, the one more point I'll bring about that is in verse 25. It talks about when you enter the land. So already, God is saying to them, this is not just about you coming out of Egypt. This is about you coming out of Egypt and coming all the way with me over here into the promised land. It's not just about freedom from captivity, but it's about entering the promise as well. And God's put that down right in here, right in this plague. When they're still in Egypt, when there's been 9 plagues and Pharaoh's still not released them, God is saying to them, this is not just about getting out of Egypt. This is about entering the promised land. So he's already created that picture in front of them. So this was the Passover that they celebrated then. God's established it as something they were supposed to do every year in the first month of the year. Now, I've done a little bit of research, and it appears that the Jewish New Year comes just before the seventh month. I'll just leave that hanging out there as something that's strange. We'll come across some strange Old Testament maths in a bit as well. So the Passover then reappears in Numbers 9, where they celebrate the Passover. I'm not going to look into that. That's just there that you can look at if you want to. But then in Joshua 5, it reappears. So actually, Joshua 4, verse 19. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. Now, they've just crossed the Jordan. They've just entered the promised land. That piece where June was taken out of captivity, she's now entered the promised land. She's crossed the Jordan, sorry, June. And she's entered the promised land. And the Israelites, they camped at Gilgal. Three things happened at Gilgal. The first one we'll pass over, we'll not talk about. But in chapter 5, verse 10, it says, on the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. The day after the Passover, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites. But that year, they ate the produce of Canaan. So they've entered the promised land and they celebrated the Passover. And there's something I really like about that, that they crossed the Jordan, they were in the land, and they celebrated the Passover, because that was the completion of what God had said to them all the way back in Egypt, that it wasn't just about coming out of there, that they entered the land and they celebrated the Passover. And then the manna stopped. The free food that they'd had for 40 years stopped, because now you're in the land. This is the place that you're supposed to be. So that's where we are with the Passover in the Old Testament. And it became a highly ritualized activity. When we went on holiday to Prague in September, and we visited the Jewish quarter in Prague, and a couple of synagogues you can open, you can look into. And one of the things that struck me was just the intricacy of the ritual. It was so detailed about everything that happened around births and about marriages and around deaths and what they had to do and all the detail of it. The one line that really struck me, it was to do with the marriage ceremony. And someone said to the bride and groom, they said, even in your happiest times, always grieve for the destruction of the temple. What a thing to say to a couple on their wedding day. Anyway, and as part of this, the Passover became a highly ritualized event. So the Passover meal, they would gather together once a year in this, I'm presuming, a nice extended family group. And they would share the cup of consecration. There would then be ritual hand washing. There would be eating of lettuce or parsley, which is supposed to symbolize the bitter herbs. And then someone would be primed. Someone in one of the children probably would be primed. Excuse me, what does this mean to you? Ah, well. And then the person leading the Passover would explain what this means to them about how the Lord instituted this back in Egypt. It was the 10th plague, and how it was completed when they arrived in the promised land. Then they would sing Psalms 113 and 114. Then there was the cup of proclamation, another drink, more hand washing, and then eating of bitter herbs between pieces of bread. That was quite a solemn part of the ceremony. And then they moved on to the celebratory part of it. They feasted on the lamb. They washed their hands again. The remaining bread was finished off. There was thanksgiving for the food. Then they had another drink, the cup of thanksgiving. Then they sang Psalms 115 to 118 and Psalm 136. And then they had the final drink, the final cup, more prayers and praise. It was a whole evening that was spent. It was a memorable festival. And one of the themes that we find with God is that he uses quite physical things to help us remember. Because actually, physical touch points help us. Baptism, we can all remember our baptism because it was a physical piece where we got drenched in water. How important is it? Some of us were in rivers, some were in swimming pools, some in baths that have been temporarily built in church buildings. Does that matter? Not really, but we remember the physical thing. And this would have been an unusual meal, a long meal, something that they would remember. They gathered together in a big group and they'd remember it. Yeah, I remember this from last year. And we'll do this again next year. We'll get together. One of the things that struck me about this was Kelly and Michelle here, they have a similar thing because they're from America and they have Thanksgiving and they have this enormous meal where families get together and they give thanks. And actually, there's a lot of overlap here. It's got kind of a different subject, but nevertheless, the family gets together, eat far too much food, which is quite memorable. So there's an overlap there. And this is the meal that they were celebrating when Jesus broke bread with them. They were celebrating the Passover meal. They gathered together in Jerusalem to celebrate this meal. So we've kind of drawn an arrow, a trajectory from Exodus all the way through to Jesus and Jerusalem. And now what we're going to do is we're going to go back. We're not going to go back quite as far as Exodus. Back as far as Egypt. I'm going to draw another arrow that's going to take us through. So when the Israelites left Egypt, they crossed the Red Sea, and they stopped in Sinai, and Moses gave them the Ten Commandments. But something else happened there. It was God laid out the design for the tabernacle. He told them, you're going to have a tent, and this is what it's going to look like. And it was very precise. And when they pitched that tent, he also told them how they were going to camp around it. So if we go to, this is, you might not be able to read this from where you are, but basically this was the tabernacle and God laid it out and he told them very precisely what it was going to look like. And in the middle, which on here is slightly to the left, but I'm going to pretend it's the middle, it's a place called the Holy of Holies. And that's where God was. God was in the Holy of Holies. And then around that were more bits of the tabernacle. Now, the Holy of Holies, no one ever went in the Holy of Holies, except for once a year, one man was allowed in. The high priest, once a year, went into the Holy of Holies. But that's what the tabernacle looked like, and then wider around that was the camp. Okay, and again, you might not be able to read this, but right in the middle, in the middle of the tabernacle is the Holy of Holies, and in the middle of the camp is the tabernacle. And around them are the Levites and the priests. Okay? That talks about the three. It talks about Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, who are the sons of Levi, and Moses and Aaron. And the priests were all descendants of Aaron. And so they camped around the tabernacle. And then around them were the 12 tribes, three to the north, three to the south, three to the east, and three to the west. Now, some of you will be wondering how Jacob had 12 sons, so there were 12 tribes of Israel. You take the Levites out, and you've still got 12. That's some good old Testament maths for you. But this is how it was done. This is how the camp was set out. God's in the middle, in the most holy place. And then around that's the tabernacle. Around that is the priests and the Levites. And then around that are the camps. So every year, in the first month, here you are. You're in one of these boxes. And every year you celebrate the Passover in your box. Now, I'm going to throw out a question. This is where we take a risk. I'm going to throw out a question. If you're sat in one of these camps on the outside, what's your kind of general feeling about how it's laid out? Because for me, it, it it all seems a little bit scary, a bit of dread and awe, and I need to be careful because kind of God's in the middle, but no one's allowed to go in and see him apart from one person once a year, and then kind of protecting, you know, to stop us getting too close, there's the priests and the Levites, and it's as if there's a buffer zone that protects us because it's a bit dangerous in there. It's a little bit scary. And actually, this is how a lot of traditional churches are still laid out. So if you go into Gloucester Cathedral, there's a kind of the scary bit at the end, the table, the altar. And that's where the priests work. And then there's the choir. And then you get further away, and there's the bit where we're allowed down here at the end. But there's a buffer zone between us, the choir. And we're kind of not allowed up there because it's a bit scary. And that's kind of how it's laid out. When I went to school, we had a chapel at school. I was at the school from quite small to up until I did my O-levels. And the chapel was laid out like this. And it was all a little bit, crikey, scary. Scary, we don't go up there. And then I got to a point where I was a bit older and I was in the choir, and we had choir practice in the chapel twice a week. And the first time I turned up, I was still a little boy, and you walk in there and it hasn't started yet, the choir master hasn't turned up, and some of the older kids, they're messing about, they're up around the altar, they're, hi, how you doing? I'm leaning on the altar. And I was thinking, you're going to get struck down, because that's the scary bit. But you learn, actually, it's not scary. It is just a table. But it kind of had all that layout. And this kind of camp, it talks about it being a bit scary. And so when we celebrate the Passover in our little box on the south or the east or wherever we are, and we're talking about God taking people out, they're saying, God, he's the one who lives over there. But, you know, it's okay because he's in his Holy of Holies, and we've got the Levites and the priests between us, and so we're okay. But that's who they were talking about. And yet, when we come to Jesus, and we come to when they celebrate the Passover in the upper room, God left the Holy of Holies, and he walked down, and he sat down at the table with the people who were celebrating. He joined them at the table. He broke down all those barriers. He broke down all of that dread and awe and scariness. And he turned the Passover into an act of love. Because I love you, I'm doing this. That's what he did. He changed it around completely. So, from this point, we've talked about a little Old Testament recap. There's kind of two ways I could take it. I could talk about sacrifice, about the sacrifice that Jesus was talking about when he broke bread and shared wine. Or I can talk about the family of believers. Because the other thing Jesus took was a festival that was designed around the family getting together, and he took it with his friends. And he celebrated, he said, we are the family, and we're doing this together as a family. So the love of Jesus pulled them together. They were the family of believers. And this is what I want to focus on. And partly because the sacrifice stuff overlaps quite a lot with the things that Steve shared last week. That's about the humility, the practicality, the spiritual side of things. But so I want to kind of talk a little bit about the family of believers. So Jesus has redefined the family group. Okay, we all have natural families, but we're also all drawn together as a family of believers. And so we're not just a bunch of guys who come to the same place on a Sunday morning because we're Christians and we happen to like the balance here or whatever. We could go to this place or that place, but we come here. It's more than that. It's different. We are a family, because with Jesus at the center, his love has drawn us together. Okay? there's almost, you know, natural families can change and people can join, but actually for most of you, there's almost no chance that our families could join together because, you know, take Steve, his kids and my kids, the ages are wrong, they'd never get together. So, you know, but Steve and I are part of the same family because we're believers. The love of Christ has drawn us together. He's brought together a disparate group, okay? We are all, quite a lot of us, we're very, very different. You know, we've got people from Durham. We've got people from Liverpool. We've got people from all over the country. We've got people from Wales. You know, we've got people from Hungary. We've got Norbert, fantastic job today. We've got Orsi, who's from some tiny village in the south of Hungary. She basically grew up on a farm, or I don't know. And we got people from Lower Canada or whatever. You know, and yet this disparate group is drawn together.
Czech Republic.
Brilliant. Sorry? Slovakia. Yeah, don't say Czech Republic, Slovakia. You know, it's great. We've got people who love rugby. We've got people who love that round ball kind of game. Basketball. You know, we're a disparate group of people, and yet we're brought together just as we are by the love of Jesus. Just like Jesus' group was a fairly disparate group, you know, with fishermen and tax collectors and Thomas, who was basically an engineer. And it's a togetherness that has its source in the love of Jesus. Family is something we are. It's not something we do. Okay, so we do things because we are a family. We don't do things to be a family. That side of things is already covered by the love of Jesus. And we are different, and we have different strengths and weaknesses. We have some people who are very, very bad at DIY. And luckily, we have some people who are very good at it. Okay, I'm in the bad category. Brian's in the good category. Okay, So when there's DIY going on here, you don't want me doing the DIY. So I come here and I say, just give me heavy things to move. You know, I can move stuff from A to B, but you really don't want me cutting wood or anything that requires the vaguest amount of skill in that. We have some people who are skilled musicians and they, you know, and we're blessed by them. We have other people who are skilled at various other things that we do. Something about being in a family is we want each other's success, okay? In the world, there's competition. I want to succeed, and if I'm going to succeed, that means I have to do better than you, so you probably have to fail. So, tough luck, but hey, we're in competition. But that's not how it is here. We want each other's success. We feel each other's pain. We want each other to succeed. I'm really hoping he doesn't listen to podcasts. My son, Oliver, Ollie, as he's known, he's not here. He's down in Bath. He loves football. But he is pretty much the most unsporting person in the entire world. I blame his parents. He loves football, but he can't play football. He's just hopelessly unsporting. Back in 2011, which is quite a long time ago now, we went to New Zealand for Christmas, and I've got family out there, and we went for a kickabout with his cousins and me and my cousin out there, and it was really nice because actually it was a game of football, but it wasn't about I'm gonna find your weak spot and I'm gonna take you on, I'm going to show I can expose you, I can beat you. It was just about fun. It was nice. And that's probably the best game of football Ollie's ever had. Because every other time, there's people who've been saying, oh, I can run past you because you're slow. Because we were family and we wanted each other's success. It's not about weakness, it's about strengths and success and being together. Okay? A very important point I'm going to make now. So our meetings together, they don't finish at 12 o'clock. And when I say that, I don't mean they don't finish at 12 o'clock because Mark goes on too long. What I mean is, there's a very important piece that happens when someone stands at the front and says, the meeting's over. And that's where we start being a family again. Okay, because basically we've come here and we've sat in rows. Now, I don't know what your houses are like, but in my house, we don't sit in rows like that. We also, in my house, no one gets to talk for very long before they're interrupted. So this is another thing that's slightly different. But, you know, when we're having our teas and coffees, that's family. That's when we're getting together and we're saying, how are you? You know, we're encouraging others' success and we're feeling their pain and we're arranging things like that. Now, a lot of what I said about family is a bit inward-looking. But one really important point to make is that actually it's not a closed family. It's an open family. So we need to be a bit outward-looking as well and welcoming. If we get it right, the love of Jesus within us is clearly apparent. People who come will see that we're not just a bunch of people sat in the same building for a couple of hours on a Sunday. It's something that can draw people in. So, I'll come back to that point a bit later. We'll go back to the scriptures. The breaking of bread with Jesus in the upper room appears-ish in all the Gospels. John 13, it's a little bit questionable whether it really is or not. So I've put that up there, but those are where they are. I'll read out the bit that's in Luke. Then came the day of unleavened bread, on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, go and make preparations for us to eat the Passover. Where do you want us to prepare for it? As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters. It just reads to me like one of those spy stories where they say, I will be wearing a red carnation. You'll meet a man carrying water. Anyway, I'm getting carried away. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, the teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there. They left and found things just as Jesus had told them, so they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table. And he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God. After taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, gave thanks and broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. Now, this is all very familiar to us. It says very similar things in Mark and Matthew. And what Jesus has done is he's changed the focus of what they were doing. The Passover was about release from captivity in Egypt and being brought into the promised land. What Jesus is changing it around is it's release of captivity from sin. And it's not just about Israel, it's about all mankind. And it's not just released from captivity, but it's being brought into the promise. The promises that God has for us.
Yeah.
So Jesus has changed that focus. And he's saying, do this in remembrance of me. Now these bits probably came from the breaking of bread and the drink. Came from probably the second half of the ceremony that we outlined earlier. But what's very apparent from Scripture is, as soon as you get into the book of Acts, we find that they're doing this loads. It talks about that they broke bread in houses. They went from house to house breaking bread. So they changed it. They didn't leave it as a big once in a year event. They changed it to a routine. Every time we get together, we just say, remember, this is why we're here. Remember why we're here. We break bread. And it probably wasn't unusual bread and it wasn't unusual wine, but it's just the repetition of doing it. Remember, this is why we're here. We're getting together, we're family, we're doing this because of Jesus. Because Jesus is what's at central. Jesus is the thing, Jesus is the one who's brought us together, who's turned us into a family.
Yes.
Okay. And the love of Jesus draws us together. Okay. So whereas last week Steve was talking about kind of individual acts, what I've been talking about today is the family together, the community that we've been created. And it says in John 13, a new command I give you, love one another. As I've loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So that love being seen lets people know that actually there's not just something different about them, but there's something special about this group. There's something extraordinary about these people, that these people who don't really gel, who shouldn't get on, they gel and they care about each other. They love one another. And that draws people in. Okay? I've decided to kind of close with my favourite verse. Zechariah 8:23. Let us go with you, because we have heard that God is with you. Okay? If people see the love of Christ within us, if that's working, if that's effective, if we get that right, the love of Jesus is apparent, that draws people in. Okay? I'm not an evangelist, but quite often it strikes me evangelists, quite often they can't give it away. You know, but this makes us wanted. This draws people into us. They see what we have.